I'd like to welcome you to the 8th ARMA lecture. I'm Tony Wolfe, I'm the chair of ARMA, and I'm really pleased to invite you to this opportunity to really be stimulated to think about health policy and how we can influence it to the benefit of people with musculoskeletal conditions and get better recognition of the importance of mobility and dexterity and being independent, and how we are so that our musculoskeletal health, our physical capacity, is so core to our beings. And I think we're going to have a very stimulating talk and plenty of opportunity for discussion afterwards. So we come here from across the musculoskeletal community. As you know, those who are part of ARMA, but those who are not, ARMA brings together all the different stakeholders relevant to musculoskeletal health: the professional groups, rheumatologists, orthopedic surgeons, rehabilitationists, osteopaths, chiropractors, primary care, the whole spectrum, along with the patient organisations and also the research funders as well, all with a common goal of improving the quality of life of people with these conditions. It's good to see such a good turnout, and we know that a few people have had to send their apologies because of the seasonal colds going around, but I think we have a very good spectrum here tonight. As I said, the key thing about ARMA is that we bring together that community and try and look for commonality of how to shift up our agenda and advance the priority and therefore access to care. Because still, despite how frequent these conditions are, there is generally a lack of policies and priorities for them. One of our challenges is that we have such a wide range of disparate conditions. We have back pain, regional pain syndromes, osteoporosis and fragility fractures, osteoarthritis, inflammatory arthritis, rare inflammatory conditions, and injuries and other things which happen, occupational problems as well. But the commonality is pain and loss of function, and therefore major impact of quality of life. And as you are also aware, that these conditions now have been shown to be the biggest cause of disability in the UK, causing 30%, but now worldwide the biggest cause of disability in all parts of the globe. And that's therefore outweighing infectious diseases and other long-term conditions. So very important that there is more priority. Tonight we're going to be focusing on MSK leading the way in a changing landscape. As I said, we know that these are the biggest cause of problems, but we do not yet have the solutions in place. We probably know about what a lot of the solutions are, but it's how do we actually get them implemented? Because this burden is actually preventable. The benefits are enormous. At the moment, there's a lot of interest around work loss and to reduce the amount of work loss, to reduce the cost of work loss, but also enable people to be more independent and work. And for once, we now see MSK as a priority area because that is recognised as having such a major impact. And we need this recognition across all areas of health because we do have a lot of cost-effective interventions. So there are potentially a lot of big wins if we can, which will have great savings for our health and social care systems. We're really pleased as an alliance that we're bringing together the members to work with the policymakers, so we are now having regular discussions with NHS England and Public Health England, DWP and others about how to change things. So I think things are going to move in a much more positive direction. So before I go on to introducing our speaker, I'd like to just give a little bit of housekeeping, ask you to put your phones on silent. But if you're on Twitter, then we encourage you to tweet, and it's hashtag ARMALecture. Whatever that means. And for Wi-Fi, it's RCHOG guest, but there's no password. But obviously, you only need that if you're going to be tweeting or in other ways communicating about this event. So now I'd like to move on to the real purpose of tonight, and it's an absolute pleasure to introduce our guest speaker, Stephen Dorrell. Stephen's held a broad range of roles over a very long and distinguished career as an MP, particularly as Health Secretary under John Major, and most recently as Chair of Parliament's Health Select Committee, stepping down in 2015. He's continuing his involvement within the health sector as chair of the NHS Confederation, which represents all organisations that plan, commission, deliver NHS services, in a way, a parallel to what ARMA is trying to do in our community. And also, ARMA is actually working with the NHS Confederation on our clinical networks project, and we're very pleased to be in that working relationship with them. So we're very fortunate tonight to have someone of Stephen's calibre and experience, knowledge of the system, to really put his thoughts into this area, and we very much look forward to what he's going to discuss with us. And as I said, he's very willing and keen to actually have a discussion with us afterwards to really generate a debate. So thank you very much, Stephen.
Anthony, first of all, thank you very much to you and to ARMA for arranging this lecture. I always feel slightly intimidated when I'm asked to come and deliver a lecture to a row of experts seated with notes, and even worse when they've got Twitter feeds and other ways that they can share their thoughts over in a passive sense while I develop mine in front of you. You can call the expert. If I develop an argument that you feel uncomfortable with, then you can share it and you can get a reply back, and you can have the whole world to get your response developed as I offer you my thoughts in lecture form. What I actually would prefer to do is to offer you some thoughts, I hope stimulate some thinking, even possibly some discussion with people outside the room. But then, having done that, that we can have a dialogue within the room. One of the ways I impress or try to impress my children, now aged between 18 and 28, is to remind them that one of the things you get late in a political life is an invitation to become a visiting professor at various august academic institutions. So impressing upon them that when they argue with me, they're arguing with a professor is one of the ways that I try to claim authority. But it's entirely unsuccessful. So please don't be intimidated by the lecture format. What I hope we can have is a proper discussion. When Anthony introduced me, he said that what we lack in the musculoskeletal field is policy. And I must say, I haven't previously been to too many healthcare public service audiences where the key lack has been identified as a lack of policy. I know exactly what you mean, Anthony, about thought-through policy frameworks that deliver outcomes, and that's exactly what I would like to talk about. But actually, part of the problem, it seems to me, is that we've suffered over a very long period from one policy initiative after another, rather than a more considered reflection on what the policy framework needs to be to allow people to deliver long-term change, long-term value to the people who rely on public services. And that's where I hope the discussion can go this evening. But as I was reflecting on what I wanted to say, I read the briefing that was very helpfully provided to me by ARMA about the range of conditions that are covered by the Musculoskeletal Alliance, the range of conditions that come together to be this, to provide this kind of limitation to people's enjoyment of life. And it's absolutely right to say that in the policy community there's a tendency to think about the impact of mental health conditions, or we all know the power of the advocacy of people who suffer from cancer or from heart disease, joining together the different conditions that come together in the musculoskeletal field is a relatively new policy development, and it's one that I very much welcome, and I welcome the fact that the NHS Confederation has been involved in seeking to empower that point of view through improved networks, improved voice, improved understanding, actually not of the things that are different for people with musculoskeletal conditions, and this is the point that I want to draw out and emphasize this evening, actually the things that are the same. Whether you suffer from limitation on your ability to enjoy a full and rewarding life as a result of suffering from a musculoskeletal condition or from a mental health condition or from diabetes is another fashionable cause. It's the common themes that I think are striking when you stop and consider these questions. So, what I absolutely am not going to talk about this evening is rheumatoid arthritis or osteoporosis or gout or vasculitis or even simple back pain. I can talk about simple back pain from a point of view of some expertise. I can't talk about any of the other things from the position of any kind of expertise when compared with the people in this room. But I think it's important not to talk about the conditions, it's to talk about the impact on the lives of the people who suffer from those conditions. Nor am I going to talk, although I often do in a different context, about the value I attach to the caring professions who work in supporting people with these conditions. I do think the voice of the caring profession, the medical profession, the nursing profession, the full range of clinical and non-clinical professions that come together to provide supportive services, that's an important voice. But it's not the theme that I want to develop this evening. Nor do I actually want to talk much about service models, which institutional arrangement delivers what kind of good service to people who suffer from individual conditions. Nor even, although we may come back to this in discussion at the end, do I really want to talk about money. Not because I want to avoid the subject, but because if we're not careful in public service policy space, the only thing we ever end up talking about is money. And sometimes that just becomes a displacement activity. We can recognize that it isn't as good as it could be and as good as it should be, and we can dream of a world where money makes all the problems go away. But actually, there is no such world. And there are always choices to be made. There are always difficult questions to be addressed. They can be made easier or more difficult by financial questions, but the policy questions, the consistent themes of policy, will be there at virtually any level of funding. So if I'm not going to talk about any of those things, what am I going to talk about? What I want to talk about is people. Not patients, not service users, just people, citizens. My next-door neighbour, my family, the people who used to elect me when I was a Member of Parliament, people who may or may not have these conditions, but people, what I want to talk about is how those of us who are interested in this field of policy should be focusing our minds on their lived experience. There's a great tendency when we talk about public service reform. It's a theme. You can always gather together an audience in a lecture theatre to talk about themes of public service reform. And what we default to doing is talking about structures and processes and professions and money and all these things. But the danger always is that when we do that, we miss the point. David Nicholson always used to say, it's a wonderful phrase, I repeat it endlessly, we hit the target and miss the point. We engage in discussion about intermediate objectives. We don't focus on the real end result. And that is people, what I as a citizen, what I think every person in this room as a citizen, wants to feel that policy is targeted to deliver, is the opportunity to lead rewarding, fulfilling lives. And the reason I start there, and the person I quite often quote in starting there, is Howard Bernstein, the man who's been the most powerful advocate of a different view of public services generally and healthcare as part of public services in Greater Manchester. chief executive, now retiring, I'm sorry to say, actually, retiring chief executive of Manchester City Council, the person who was has thought more about these subjects than most other public servants. And it's very striking, whenever Howard talks about these subjects, he doesn't talk about the... He does, ultimately, gets there, but it's at the very much at the back end of what he says. He doesn't talk primarily about joining up health and social care or about the need to pass information more effectively around the health and care system or to use the estate more. All of these things are important. What he always starts off by saying is this is about creating livable communities, is his phrase. Places where people will lead rewarding, fulfilling lives, where they have jobs that they find rewarding and fulfilling, where there are public spaces that give them enrichment in the proper sense of the term, where there's housing and a range of other services available to them, some of them self-paid, some of them tax-funded, depending on the service, depending on the circumstance, but all of them a range of services available to support the ambition we all have as citizens to lead rewarding, fulfilling lives. That's important for every one of us, and it's, the key starting point in discussion about the care, proper care for people with musculoskeletal conditions, just as it's the proper starting point for people with mental health issues, people who suffer from other forms of acute or less acute illness. The list of things that are important to us: our loving relationships, the ability to relate to and enjoy personal relationships, the ability to achieve the satisfaction, the social and economic returns out of fulfilling employment, housing, recreation, engagement with the communities in which we live. Those things are important to everyone in this room. Actually, you wouldn't be here if those things weren't important to you. Not one of you would come if you didn't think that some of those things were important. But they're important to everyone, every one of us as individuals. You don't have to be an Olympic athlete to think those things are important. And if the gold standard of physical fitness, physical or mental fitness, was Olympic athlete status, all of us in this room, unless there's a hidden talent somewhere in the room, all of us are in that, by that measure, somewhere less than 100% fit. I certainly am. But so you don't have to. The point I'm trying to emphasise is that each one of us will fall short of the perfect human experience. But what we need to do, as whether we suffer from a full life condition, many of our citizens suffer from less than perfect human form through full life conditions. Others encounter those conditions during their lives and live with them for the rest of their lives. Some of us are unfortunate and enjoy good health until later in life, but aging, just the simple process of aging, means that we require a range of services to enable us to lead fulfilling, rewarding lives, the phrase again, for as long as possible during our natural lifetime. And that's the context in which these different disease groups, it seems to me, need to be seen. What we're about is creating a range of services that allow people to lead rewarding, fulfilling lives. One other important point, of course, is that we might start with belonging to none of the specific communities, whether it's cancer and heart disease, mental health conditions, diabetes, musculoskeletal. We may not be a member of any of those communities to start with. We then become a member, and you don't opt out of one community to become another. I'm still Stephen, as my life experience engages me with different parts of these services. I am still a citizen. I'm still me. And what we should be seeking to do is to provide a range of services which allow me and all my fellow citizens to get the maximum possible benefit out of life. Now, I labour this point, you may think, because I do think it leads to a completely different way of thinking about the services that each one of us in this room are interested in, the role that the specialist can play in delivering that long-term global objective. It leads to a different way, in particular, of thinking about the National Health Service, and I'm going to be very specific for a second, because the National Health Service is, as we all know, we all believe, a very key public service. It's actually two things, I think, the National Health Service. It's an expression of values. The reason that it's famously described as the nearest thing we have to an established church, the reason that we all sign up to the National Health Service, is that it is an expression of values. That's why Danny Boyle made such a splash in the Olympic opening ceremony by celebrating it, because it was an expression of shared values. Unfortunately, in addition to being an expression of shared values, it's also a collection of national silos, different bits of service that, if we tested them against the vision of joined up services supporting citizens leading the kind of lives that I've been describing, would actually fall short of the expression of values that Danny Boyle's spectacular gave expression to. Too often, in my view, the National Health Service dresses itself in rhetoric about its important expression of national values and becomes a gleaming city on the hill. In some cases, literally. I have been until recently the founding chair of the Birmingham STP. Anybody who knows the geography of Birmingham will know that one of the big success stories, actually, of the private finance initiative was the rebuilding of the Queen Elizabeth Hospital in Birmingham on a hill. And you drive into Birmingham from the southwest, and it's white. It's on the top of a hill. It's a huge statement of our commitment to the principles of the NHS, but it is literally, physically, a city on the hill. And the challenge for those who care about the more joined-up view that I started off by seeking to articulate is to get the National Health Service to come down off the hill, to engage, to get used to the fact that, yes, it's an expression of values, and we all sign up to the values, but the services delivered by the National Health Service are just part of the range of public services that are delivered in each locality around the country. And the sense of separation that comes for all kinds of cultural, institutional reasons around the National Health Service is actually a disservice to the delivery, to the objective that I started out by describing. Now, this sense that the NHS has to learn to embed, to forget its sense of specialness and to recognise that the values are shared out in public service but outside the National Health Service, I think is fundamental to success if we're going to deliver the objective that I was describing. It's often said that this is about joining up the NHS and social care. We've grown used in recent times to the proposition it used to be regarded as, I'm not sure it was controversial, but it was certainly pushing the argument a bit when I was in the chair of the House of Commons Select Committee, to argue that it's no good looking at the NHS and averting your eyes from social care. Health and care, if you're a citizen, you don't want to be in an acute hospital. You want a range of services that provide care and support and ensure that you can get into the acute hospital when you need to, but equally important, you can get out of it when you When you no longer need to be there, and preferably avoid being there in the first place. So joining health and care is a theme that we are now reasonably familiar with. But what I want you to think about is that if the objective is, as I described, rewarding, fulfilling lives, the exam question surely is which public service in the place in which you live is not motivated by the desire to support citizens leading fulfilling, rewarding lives? Which public service doesn't support and reinforce the objectives that we embrace through our embracing of the National Health Service? Which, let me just list them. Housing. When we create structures to deliver improved social housing, that was actually in the 19th century, historically, improved housing was one of the things that made the most dramatic difference to the health, the lived experience, the public health standards of the age. Housing is just as much part of health policy as hospitals. Similarly, education. How does it come that we think we can run paediatric services, whether it's paediatric musculoskeletal health or whether it's paediatric mental health or paediatric services for children, how do we think we can provide that divorced from, in a different silo from, the education service to the same child? One of the other things I do, apart from the NHS Confederation, is that I'm a trustee of Place to Be, which provides mental health services to children in schools where either the child or the parent have mental health issues. You cut the funding available, or you reduce you make choices within the education budget which limit funding for that kind of service. And what does that do to the objective of rewarding, fulfilling lives for both the child, in that case, and also for the family? So the point that I'm seeking to draw out is that public services are a continuum. It's not health, education, housing, even libraries. You cut the library service, the cup of coffee isn't available, the elderly person doesn't have a meeting place, they become isolated at home, they develop a sense of isolation, a mental health problem, and you're all familiar with the knock-on effect. So whichever of these conditions we're talking about, my strong, increasingly strong belief is that we have to understand that it's a continuum, and that the objective must be all the time to build a range of services within a place that enable people to lead fulfilling, rewarding lives.